Okay, so welcome back everybody to Interventional Medical Image Processing. Everything okay? Yes, okay, good. So, welcome. Wow, you're going so far back. So there's competition. Okay, so today we will talk about the last chapter in pre-processing, and what we are gonna look at today is image super resolution. So it says super resolution image reconstruction, and you will find that the way of processing super resolution images is very similar to a reconstruction process. So we will first discuss what is super resolution, what is the idea of super resolution. Then we will talk a bit about cameras and sampling and what actually happens when you discretize an image. And this is followed by a single and multi-camera super resolution. So there's two different kinds of methods. So you can do super resolution with a single camera, so with a single frame using prior knowledge. Or you use multi-frame super resolution, there you have a sequence of frames, and you use an estimate of the motion in between to compute super resolved images. Based on that, we will then look into statistically based super resolution. So the idea is that there is also a relation to the image statistics, to the noise statistics that you can build in order to design super resolution approaches, and we will finish by take-home messages. Okay, so what is super resolution? So you may know CSI Miami or one of these nice television series, and there they do super resolution all the time. So they take a video and then they zoom in into the mirror of a car, and then there is a reflection and you zoom further in. And this is basically the idea of super resolution. And you will see today that if you actually try to do that, it's actually much harder than in the videos. So we won't be zooming into images and looking into reflections and then recognize faces and reconstruct them. So we won't be able to do that. But it's still a fancy technique, so it's still very nice. And we will have a couple of examples of different modalities where we applied super resolution. One nice thing is you can use, for example, multi-frame or multiple sensors, and in this way you can get quite high resolution images from a pretty cheap sensor. So this is one application where super resolution became popular in the last few years, because you can use it in a very cheap sensor technology. The downside is, of course, the money you save in your sensor, you have to spend on computation time. Yeah. So you probably can use very cheap sensors, and then you ship a cluster with it in order to compute the super resolved images. Now, you can do that on, for example, on graphics hardware very efficiently, and but there's a considerable amount of computing required. Okay. So let's go to the problem description. A real imaging system performs a non-ideal mapping of a scene to some kind of image plane. This is the image plane of your camera, and it does a non-ideal mapping. And there's a couple of steps happening in between. So if you consider your image plane and your sampling there, first of all, you have to sample or essentially downsample. So the signal that you get actually has, if you consider it as a continuous signal, it is in general, it may contain very high frequencies and very good resolutions therewith, and you have to map it onto a discrete space. And what you assume typically for a super resolution approach is that the original image that you want to reconstruct has higher frequencies than you actually collect in your downsampled signal. So you're always collecting a downsampled version of the original signal. So this has a lower resolution than the actual image that you're expecting. And of course, there's also other things happening. So generally, there is a certain blur introduced by your sensor, And there's of course noise. So by photon statistics, if you don't have enough light, it may introduce noise, or generally introduced by the sensor, by quantization. So there's different kinds of noise that could affect the image. And the result is that small details, like high frequency, spatial high frequency details, get lost in this 2D image. And now the super resolution is, I want to estimate a good approximation of the ideal image, or the high the super resolved or the high resolution image, from this real low resolution image data. And one example are typically surveillance cameras. So you have plenty of surveillance cameras around, and you want to improve image quality. So you want to zoom into the reflections of a car and then recognize faces and things like that. And then there's, of course, military applications. So you want to super resolve, for example, satellite images and things like that to get a better view of the enemy territory, for example. But of course, we don't talk about such applications here, so we don't do these evil things. What we are doing is very good, because we work in medical imaging, so all we do is for the benefit of mankind, and there's nothing to worry about. So, the applications that we have here is, we have ophthalmic imaging, so eye imaging. This is one application where we applied this, and for example, in this research project we were working on, the idea is that you could combine a low-cost fundus camera, so a camera where you look at the background of the eye, and you choose a cheaper sensor and also a cheaper device, and you lose resolution by that, but the device is very cheap. And if you can manufacture a cheap device and then you can compute the super resolved image from that, you potentially could manufacture the device much cheaper. And this kind of approaches typically targets third world countries. So if you want to, you could develop special devices that could be used there, and there you typically need to be cost effective. Yeah? So you don't want to have the newest, very expensive systems there, because probably nobody can pay for it. Even if you have people that donate, it's much easier to supply systems that are not as costly, and you can reach a much broader, not audience, but a much broader amount of people, and you can actually help them. So this is one of the ideas that was driven by us here. And then typically, those time-of-flight sensors that you've seen in the lecture here, they typically have pretty low resolution. So also for time-of-flight sensors, it makes sense to work with super-resolving images. And there, the reason is simply the current sensor technology is not yet there to do really high-resolution images. And you can already work with super-resolution to improve the image quality. So you could enhance 3D depth images using these techniques, for example, in an endoscope. So here we have a very nice example. On the left, you see the image, the original raw data image. And this is just a bicubic upsampling, where you just oversample. And you can see, of course, one thing is this upsampling also preserves the noise. So this is kind of noisy, this image. And it also smears edges considerably. And on the right-hand side, you see the result of a super resolution. Yeah. So this is the super resolved image, and this is the input image. We have a couple of more exciting examples to follow, but this is about what you can get. Yeah. So you can maybe a factor of 2. You maybe even to get a factor of 4 or 8, depending on how many images or how much prior knowledge you have. But you're not zooming into the reflection of a car and recognize faces or something like this. So you can considerably increase image quality, but there's of course limits. Yeah? So a factor of 2 is already pretty good. If you can go for 4, that's quite a lot. Okay, so this is what we want to do, and actually it's pretty hard to get the image on the right, because there's a number of traps that you can fall into, and if you just do the straightforward implementation, you probably don't get the result that you wanted to have. So let's look at the basics first. So let's look a bit at cameras and sampling. So if you consider your signal to be a continuous real-valued signal, and we call it f of xy, because we generally now work with images, then you can sample the image in x and y direction. And what you do is you compute a discrete representation, and this is now this value here. So this is the pixel f mn, so this is the pixel location m and n. And you do that by sampling your continuous signal in discrete steps of delta x and delta y. And this is how you compute one value of your discrete representation. So you have to cut out like one value of your discrete signal. And this is one value of your continuous signal to get the discrete representation. And delta x and delta y are the sampling rates. And this essentially refers to your pixel spacing. So this is how far your pixels are apart from each other. And for a finite regular grid, it makes sense to limit this to a range x0 and x1. So you don't have an infinite amount of sampling points. Of course, you start at index 0, and then you go up to 620 or 480 or 2048. So there's a finite number of grid points, and this is also determined by the matrix. So your imaging matrix, the number of pixels determines the points where you sample your continuous function. Well, is it possible to reconstruct your continuous function or not without loss of information? Well, this is actually the sampling theory, right? So you all know that. You can more mathematically describe this ideal sampling by a sequence of Dirac delta functions. So if you select one value, this is essentially like multiplying with a Dirac function. So you take the original image and you multiply it with the Dirac function, and you get exactly this single point. And there you have, here we have a discrete version of the Dirac delta function that is exactly 1 at x equals 0 and y equals 0 and 0 otherwise. And then the discrete samplings are determined by a multiplication of your Dirac function with the original signal. Huh? That's already it. Good. Then you can also have a look at the Fourier transform of our original signal. And generally, we consider our signal to be band-limited, which means there are coefficients in the Fourier transform that are at frequencies that are higher than the band limitation, then we get only zero values. So no frequencies appear that are higher than u0 in x direction, if we consider u as the frequency variable in x direction. And there is no frequency in v direction that is higher than v0. So we generally have a limited signal. And now the sampling theorem essentially says that you can reconstruct your original signal if your sampling rate is twice as high as the maximum frequency that appears in your signal. And you can just think of the simple example. If you want to sample a frequency of this length, then you have to sample like 2 times that you can actually distinguish this peak from each other. And if you have a frequency that goes like this and you sample only 2 times in here, then you won't get the correct frequency, but what you would reconstruct would be a wrong frequency. Yeah, but this is just a refresher, so all of you know this, right? you heard about sampling theorem plenty of times. Okay. Who hasn't heard about the sampling theorem? Only two, three? Well, this is it. You have to sample with the double frequency, then the highest frequency in your signal. And this is the general rule here. Good. In other words, we can reconstruct f of x, y from our discrete coefficients, from our pixel values, if your pixel pitch is high enough. And here the high pixel pitch means that the pixels need to be small. You need to have small pixels in order to reconstruct the entire signal, in order to get the original continuous signal. And if you don't, if this is not fulfilled, you can, for example, see it in the pattern here. So here we have a slight rotation. You see on the left side, there is this kind of checkerboard pattern, and it's slightly rotated. And what happens if you now start sampling with the frequency of the checkerboard pattern here? You will get effects that you can't explain with your current sampling mask. So this slight rotation here that we can observe in the left signal, because it has a much smaller pixel size, there we are able to identify this rotation that has happened. And if we now try to sample this at a fixed frequency that is the same as the checkerboard pattern, then you will see that we get these aliasing effects. You see here? So this is a regular grid, and here the irregularity of the grid breaks apart in regular intervals. And this is because there is an effect happening to our grid, and this, it's this rotation. And this effect has a higher frequency than our sampling frequency, which leads to a wrong reconstruction of the original signal on the right side. Okay? So this is what happens if you have a violation of sampling theorem. And of course, you already know that from school, that if you have a wheel that rotates very fast, and if it rotates too fast, then the sampling rate of your visual system, you will get the impression that it suddenly spins backwards. And this is also a violation of the sampling theorem. So there's a frequency appearing that you cannot sample correctly, and then you have the effect that you don't get the correct reconstruction of the original signal. Okay, so sampling theorem is actually something very basic, and you should have had experiences with violations of the sampling theorem quite often, and maybe you just didn't notice. Good. Now, the sampling of real cameras, in real cameras, you don't have ideal Dirac functions. So in a real camera, your chip, your sensor, also introduces some kind of averaging, because if you consider your pixel, it essentially integrates over the entire area of your pixel. And what is happening is you essentially can model this with a point spread function. So there's a kind of blurring, for example, introduced. And this reason, so you still get your discrete sample by this convolution, but now we don't have ideal Dirac pulses more in here, but we have a point spread function that we call h of xy. And now the point spread function is a very useful quantity, or a very useful description of your imaging system, because from the point spread function you can derive the limiting frequency. And the point spread function essentially tells you, that's where the name comes from, if you have an ideal point that has is just a single point, so it's infinitely small, and this point is imaged by a system, then you will still have a certain extent. And if you measure this extent, so the spread of this ideal point, how it is spread on your sensor, is the point spread function. And there's different ways of determining the point spread function. Of course, you can measure it. If you have built your system, you can. There's different techniques for measuring it. So you need an object that is smaller than the resolution of your imaging system, and then you image this object, and then you can have a look at the point spectral function. The other way is you can also theoretically derive point spectral functions. So if you're building a system, the first thing that you do is, before you actually assemble a new detector or a new camera, you start with theoretical considerations on how the point spread function would look. But we are not going into this in detail. But typically, when you design a sensor, you first do some simulations and some computations about the point spread function, and then you build the sensor, and what you typically observe is that your estimation was typically too optimistic, and you, in the end, measure a slight deviation from your theoretical result. And if you have a very good model that explains all the effects that are actually happening in your sensor system, then you should be able to measure the point spread function that you have first theoretically derived. So if you did your planning very accurately, you should end up with the same point spread function in the measurement than in the actual simulation. Okay, so the point spread function, for us, the point spread function just tells us that there is a blurring happening of the original signal. And we can model this in our system as a convolution of the original function with the point spread function. So what we are measuring is a discrete, a sampled version of the continuous function convolved with the point spread function. So this is what you measure. Well, so now we have modeled the ideal camera. Now we started introducing a blur. And you can have the effect here. So if you have an ideal pulse sequence of Dirac pulses, your point spread function looks like this. And if this is a single pixel, then you get exactly this single point here. And now if you start introducing a point spread function that introduces a certain blur, you can see that you lose resolution at the edges. So do you typically measure resolution at edges? And at edges, you can also see the loss in high frequency information that is introduced by the blur. And now you can see this is no longer a steep edge, but there's an intermediate step. So this is caused by the blurring of the point spread function. Okay, so now we know that there's blur. So, but there's a different effect also appearing, that is, of course, noise. And noise is typically modeled as an additive quantity. And noise has different sources. For example, it could be, if you have low lighting conditions, there could be photon statistics could be a cause for noise. And of course, there's also quantization noise. So what your sensor typically does is you sample the value and then you quantize to 8-bit or to 24-bit if it's a color image. And this quantization also introduces an error, and this is considered as noise. So this is the quantization noise. Then there's further noise in the sensor array, and now we can define our total observation model, and this observation model is the continuous function convolved with the point spread function. Then we sample, and then we add the quantization noise. And here we assume spatially invariant Gaussian noise, but this may be different on your modality. So if you have X-ray images, you will have spatially variant noise depending on the length of your line integrals, for example. So this is a simplified model. Okay, so this is our observation model. And now the thing is, what we want to reconstruct essentially is this f of xy. This is what we want to do. And if we want to do that, we will have to perform the following steps. Well, we will have to upsample. We will have to increase the resolution. Then we have to deblur. So we have to remove the blurring that was introduced by our point spread function. And the third step is denoising, so you have to suppress the additive noise. So these are the three essential steps that you need to do to reconstruct the super resolved image. So the super resolution problem is actually nothing else than an estimation of a discrete version of f of xy with an increased resolution compared to our discrete version FMN. That's already it. So that's the entire process of super resolution. Good. Now we could have different ideas. So we have the single image observed, and from a single image it's hard to say what a better image is. So you could have different approaches how to increase the image resolution. And there's typically the two approaches, single frame and multi-frame. And in single frame super resolution, you have a single image, and you try to improve it. And what you so most common versions are learning-based methods. Here you try to estimate the high-resolution image by learning the degradation process. So, for example, you may use prior knowledge on the shape of your object. So if you know you're imaging images of spheres, you can use the prior knowledge that your image needs to be a perfect sphere. And then you can guide the deblurring and denoising process to make the image better. But and you can also not use just spheres, but you can also use a different classifier. So you can learn from, let's say you learn from CT slice data or from typical objects that you expect to observe in your image data. And if you then upsample, you will use the prior knowledge on how these objects or items look like in a high resolution, and you just make your low resolution image look like a high resolution image by the information that it should look like this. Now the problem if you do that is this depends on your training data. So if you do that in medical data, for example, and you train all your data with healthy patients, you may end up with the problem that if you have a patient that has a tumor, that the system will fail in super resolving the tumor because it hasn't seen this in the training data. So there's always, you always have to consider that if you use learning-based methods, you really need a training data that comprises hopefully all the cases that you expect to see in your data. And in medical imaging, this is pretty tough. So if you have a very tailored application, let's say you do material testing and you have a CAD model of the part that you're investigating, and you're only looking for deviations from that CAD model, you can constrain much more with prior knowledge than you would do it in medical data. In medical data, you always have to model the variance of the patient that you're going to expect. Good. And then there's also frequency interpolation methods. So, for example, you could sample in a wavelet domain with wavelet coefficients, and you could force that, for example, the super-resolved image needs to be wavelet sparse or things like that. So you can also do that in frequency domain. But again, you introduce some kind of prior knowledge that, and if you violate this assumption, you may end up with not very good results. Multi-frame super resolution does a different approach. So here we are more in the data-driven approach. So multi-frame, and we will stay mostly with multi-frame super resolution in the following. And here the idea is that you have essentially your continuous representation is here. It's the white area here. So by the way, if you were upsampling a perfectly white image, that's not very difficult. If you don't have noise, it's very easy to create a super resolved image of something that doesn't have any frequencies because you will still get the same result. But let's say there would be an object here in the field of view, and what you do is you take the same sensor and move it by pixel pitches that are smaller than the pixel size. So you could, for example, do this by piezo elements, or there's also people that have been working with random motion, but it's better if you know the motion. Let's say you have some small piezo element where you can shift by a quarter pixel pitch, and then you can shift around your camera. And if you combine the two piezo elements, one on the left and one on the bottom, then you can move your sensor matrix by locations that are smaller than the actual sensor, the pixel size, and in this way you will be able to acquire the same image but from slightly different positions. And it's important that the deviation is not just exactly the same as the pixel pitch, because if you just move by one pixel pitch upward or by one pixel pitch to the other side, you will be sampling the same image again. So you need to be in between the pixel pitch. And this is what we try to show with this image here. Here we have three frames and they are almost at the same position, but they are slightly shifted. And in the following, we will also assume that we know this motion. If you have, for example, a hand camera, we are trying to move, trying to go back and forth, then you have the problem that you have unknown motion as well. So then you end up, you don't know the motion, but at least you know, you usually put in that your object is static or something, or in between three frames, the object should be static, something like this. Then you can start estimating the motion, then you can compute a super resolved image, and then from the super resolved image, you can try to improve the motion estimation. Okay, but let's neglect the problem of motion estimation and let's go to a static object and also a static shift in between the sensor array.
Can only work on a lateral shift or?
Why should it only work for a lateral shift?
Sure, maybe if you tilt it or so, I think the image formation should change a lot.
You have to model that, but why not? Why should you only be so you're saying this only works with X and Y shift? So it's good to do it this way, because if you start rotating, then you have a different impact on different pixels. So you might end up with better resolution preservation or better reconstruction in some areas than others. So if you have rotation, you will get into effects like this one here, right? So you have a different shift in every pixel. And if you have a uniform shift, so if you have this XY shift, then you end up with a uniform pattern for the upsampling. So this is better for gaining a uniform super resolution. If you start rotating your sensor, then you may run into issues that the super resolution has different properties across the image domain. But in general, it should the idea should apply. Yeah. Okay. And now our goal is to reconstruct this high-resolution image from low-resolution frames. And in the following, our image will be called A in matrix notation. So generally, you think it's a 2D image, right? So your image is a matrix. But what we will do is we will align our entire image into a vector. So for us, the image will be the vector A. So it's a 1D vector where all the pixels of the image are in a long vector. And now we have high resolution images X. So X is unknown. So we want to reconstruct the high resolution image X. And then we have several instances of the low resolution image Y. And they're showing the same thing. So YK would then be the kth frame of the low resolution image sequence. And they're all showing the same thing. And what now happens in the generative process here in the simulation is, so first of all, you have the ideal image. And then there is some motion. So there's this warping. And then there's the blurring, then there's the downsampling, and then there's the noise. So this is our final complete model that we have to build one low resolution frame is a high resolved image, translate or warp, blur, downsample, noise. And the reconstruction process, the super resolution process, is the inversion of this. And what do you do? Well, as always, we put everything into a large system of equations, and then we solve the system of equations. So now we have to think about how do we model this warping, the blur, the downsampling, and the noise. And you can see that you can find a warping matrix that, oh, okay, so this is already the entire system matrix. So we put the warping, the blurring, the downsampling, everything into a big matrix, and then your downsampling process is nothing else than a system matrix of the K frame multiplied with the ideal image, and this gives you the downsampled version plus some noise. Yeah? That's it. And this is nice because this is a linear equation. Yeah? So we know how to deal with linear equations. So linear equations are nice. Yeah? So what do we do? Well, first we have to think about how does the system matrix actually look. So is this really just a matrix multiplication, or can we really form it in this way? And in fact, it's not half bad, because your convolution, you can also write it as a big matrix multiplication. So this is also possible. And you do that in a way that, first of all, your coefficients of this blurring they sum up to one. And you can, for example, choose a Gaussian point spread function, and you can, you have to determine the sigma. So hopefully you know your system parameters well, then you just know the sigma and you can put it in there. Otherwise, you have to estimate your point spread function, and then you use the estimated or measured point spread function in this process. Okay. And what else can we do? Well, we can also take the nth pixel at x, and we can, in this convolution process, we have a shift anyway, so we can also introduce the spatial warping in here. So we can describe the spatial warping and the blurring in the same matrix. Now, the system matrix consists of n columns, and n columns, because n is the number of the highly resolved image. So n is the high resolution image, that's the number of pixels in the high resolution image, and m rows, where m is the number of pixels in the low resolution image. Now, if you try to store this matrix, let's say you want to reconstruct n to the 1024 to the power of 2, and m is the is the low resolution image that has 512 to the power of 2, so you will realize that this matrix becomes pretty big. Yeah? So you need a pretty big matrix to do this. So if you want to work with this matrix representation, you typically use a sparse matrix representation. So you only store the coefficients of the matrix that are non-zero. And if you think about this sampling process, there's a lot of zero coefficients. So you only store the non-zero coefficients, and there's special libraries for that. There's sparse matrix libraries that you can use in order to represent values, or also in order to do the matrix computation and least square solvers and so on. Okay. So you can also put in this, as previously said, you can also put in this spatial warping into the same matrix. And for example, if you had a pure translation, you can model this as a homography, and you can also include rotation and translation, or generally an affine motion. So this is possible. So it will, if you only have shifts, it's easier to model. If you have rotation and translation, you need something like homogeneous coordinates, but generally you can describe it in a linear way. Okay, so now we have the basics, how we get from the ideal image, so we started with the continuous representation and talked a bit about the properties of the from continuous to discrete, and now we talked about a discrete to discrete process where we had a discrete ideal image and how it is converted into a downsampled version with all these steps. And now what we want to do is we want to inverse the process, and we do this using a statistically based superresolution. And you will see why we choose this very strange term statistically based in the following, because you can you can argue the about the application to statistics. Well, let's start with a statistical model for images. Now, if we model, we can model a high-resolution image as a kind of random variable, and the probability to observe x you can describe as p of x. And similarly, we can model a low-resolution image as a random variable, p of yk. And now what we want to do is, we want to observe a sequence of low-resolution images, so this is y1 to yk, and then assume mutual independence. And if we do that, we can use a Bayes formula. So Bayes formula tells us that if we have the probability of x given y can be, so, and now y is just a single vector where we put it, where we put all the instances of the low resolution images into a large vector. So we can also write it as the probability of x given y1 to yk. And using Bayes' theorem, we can decompose it into p of x and p of y1 to yk given x. Because what we later want to observe, what we later want to reconstruct is x, of course. And then we can simplify this by putting the y1 to yk again into a single vector, and this is simply p of x times p of y given x divided by p of y. Okay, so this is our statistical model. This is the standard Bayes formula, so everybody of you should have seen Bayes formula before. Why are we doing this? Well, now we can do a maximum likelihood estimation. So we are estimating the x that maximizes the probability. And in general, we can now assume that our x is assumed to be uniform, and we could just neglect it. But p of x, of course, could also contain some kind of prior information about observing x in general. So there might be instances of x that are more likely to appear than other instances of x. So for example, what you typically put into a prior is that you want to have an image that has less noise. So in p of x, you can generally model some prior information. But if you don't have a prior, you can assume them to be uniform. And what you will see is that this equation here, if you assume p of x to be uniform, then it will fall out of the optimization. If you optimize only for x, this part here only contains y, so it will also be irrelevant for the optimization, which means that you can describe the log likelihood given as the logarithm of this term here. And now you just have to optimize this single probability. So the goal is to reconstruct the x that explains the y the best. And what you do now is you do a maximization over your log likelihood function, and you say, I choose the x that maximizes the likelihood, or the log likelihood, so you can apply the logarithm and doesn't change the position of the maximum. So you search for the x that maximizes the likelihood given my observations. And this is a typical maximum likelihood estimation. Okay, so now this is very general. So I have to put in some kind of model for my likelihood. And what can we do? Well, we could say we put in a kind of noise model. And if we assume our noise to be spatially uncorrelated and additive with a zero mean, then we can choose this model here. So this is nothing else than a multidimensional Gaussian distribution. So what you put in here is here you assume that your mean value, and the mean value is the expected value, right? So the mean value should be the ideal image, and then the ideal image projected into the subspace. And this should be very close to our observed object, to our observation. This is what you put in here. And this is your noise model, your pixel-wise noise model. Okay. And this models the probability of yk and the dependence to x. And now you can put in the log likelihood. You can put it into your log likelihood function. And the nice thing is, first of all, this part here, there is no dependence on x. So you can get rid of this part. And then you apply the logarithm to here. And what you end up, also this 2 sigma square here is independent of your optimization because you're only optimizing for x. And what you end up is only the sum over your k images. Because if you assume the images to be independent, you multiply them all. Yeah? And if you apply the logarithm, this turns out to be a sum. So in the end, it is just a sum of L2 norms that you're optimizing. And essentially, if we assume exactly this additive Gaussian model in the generative process, we end up with nothing else than a least square solver. So if you have this Gaussian noise model with zero mean and a given standard deviation, you end up with nothing else than a least square model. Note that there is a minus in here, so this is the reason why we are switching from a maximization to a minimization. So you can multiply by -1, and then you just change the direction. So if you write this back into a vector notation, this zero mean additive noise model is nothing else than a least square solver. And the least square solvers we've seen before. Be careful if you want to work with SVD. You have to be careful here because the matrix is pretty huge. So typically you choose for iterative solvers. So you would try some gradient descent. So yeah, but this is very nice. So you take some gradient descent and you can solve this. Awesome. So we have just solved super resolution, isn't it? Least square, there you go, everything's fine. Well, for example, we could solve it with a pseudo-inverse, and this is what I just said. You take some conjugate gradient descent or FBGS or some kind of optimization algorithm, and it's a convex problem, so the iterative method converges to a global minimum. Awesome, it's solved, no problem. So let's do this. Well, if you do this, you will notice that super-resolution is an ill-posed problem. And just this maximum likelihood approach, as we just had here, will result in very unstable solutions with highly amplified noise. And you can have a look here. This is the low downsampled version, and this is the upsampled version. And here you can see the excessive noise in your different pixels. And of course, and you see this regular pattern that if you take approximately 4 pixels together, the result is pretty stable. So if you compute the average over those 4 pixels, it's pretty good. So the reason for that is, yeah, you're not punishing any outliers. And if you have 4 pixels in the neighborhood, and the sum of the 4 is exactly the value that you observe on the left here, then you will get it won't be punished. And if you have not a perfect spacing here of your sampling, all those outliers will not be punished, or they will no longer be visible in the downsampled version. And now you have 2 neighboring pixels, and you can make one very large and one very small, but their average value will still be correct. So this is why this entire process becomes very unstable. So you can have excessive noise, even you can have constellation where you don't converge, or where you just have to stop after several iterations, because in the last iterations you just increase the noise dramatically. And this is because you have this downsampling effect and you just have very, very bad noise properties in there. And you get the result on the right side. So you do a super resolution by the book, you implement it, and then you realize nothing works. Stupid. Well, maybe we can think about this problem. And there was this thing with the prior. So we just said, oh, we just say everything is uniformly distributed. We don't have information about the prior. But hey, can we use some prior information about the image in order to get a reasonable result? And well, yes, we can do that. But first, we can bash a bit more about the bad properties, about the unconstrained optimization here. And if you don't use a prior, you can get these. So this image here on the right-hand side is really good because it has a lot of high frequencies. Do you notice? So this has a lot of high frequencies, so it's a high-frequency image. So it's totally super resolved. But it's probably not what you wanted to have. Okay, good. So what can we do? Well, instead of just doing maximum likelihood, we can do something which is called maximum a posteriori estimation. And here we don't say, well, everything is uniformly distributed, but we introduce a prior. So we use this P of X in order to select solutions from our solution space that are more favorable. And one way to do that, well, generally in the framework, in the MAP framework, you then end up maximizing this likelihood. And the likelihood here is then P of X multiplied with P of Y given X. So the P of Y given X part we already know. And because this is multiplicative, if you apply the logarithm, they will just add up. So if you start then optimizing the log likelihood function, you can get back to the framework that we derived earlier. And what you will see is that we end up again in a minimization problem where we have this least square problem here. So this is essentially the data fit term. And then we have some lambda plus a regularization term. And this is what we do all the time. But the nice thing here is that we can now show that you can also end up with the same kind of optimization that you usually do, adding regularization and optimizing for a least square data term or L1 data term or some data term and some regularization. And you can very neatly derive this from a statistical framework with this MAP formulation. And this is why prior optimization or using priors in optimization from guys that come from a very statistical background, they always call it maximum a posteriori, MAP estimation. And this is if you hand in some kind of prior estimation, it's information into your estimation process. So if you go back again to this vector notation and you write everything as vectors, this is just a matrix equation, a linear matrix equation that you put into your least square term here, and you have this regularization term. And now we can design different regularizers, and those regularizers will favor certain outcomes for X. And you typically introduce a variable called lambda, where you can adjust the strength of your regularization. And if you put in too much regularization, you may end up with very strange results. So if you have, for example, edge preservation priors that preserve edges or that like edges, you may end up with a comic-like appearance with very patchy images. This is if you overdo it, then you have to reduce the influence of your regularizer. Or you can have different kinds of regularizers. And what we'll do is we will now use different regularizers and also have a look at how the statistical formulation looks like. And this gives us a statistically based super resolution approach. But generally, these are regularizers that you commonly use in many optimization problems and many image processing problems. So one thing that you can do is you can do a Gaussian prior. This will favor smooth solutions, but usually you want to do super resolution. Now you want to have a smooth result for your super resolution, then you don't get the high frequency. So you maybe it's not such a good idea to use a Gaussian prion. And then there's things like the bilinear total variation. This is a kind of total variation approach where you describe the total variation in a matrix multiplication. Or you can do stuff like a Huber prior. And the Huber prior, Huber function regularizers are very, very popular because the nice thing with the Huber prior is that you have a continuous function that essentially approximates an L1 norm. Okay. So let's have a look at this. So the Gaussian prior will be just assume that you have a Gaussian here. And you can even put in some covariance matrix here. So this is the covariance matrix of your noise that you put in, and this is your Gaussian resolution. And you can choose this Zx is essentially the smoothness that you control in there. And now you can build this MAP objective function where you have the data fit term here and this data fidelity term in here. And if you just kick out this matrix, you will realize that this X transpose X is nothing else than an L2 norm of your image. So you want to have the L2 norm of your resolution to be minimal. This you can, and you can put in some kind of covariance matrix in here, then you have a weighted L2 norm. So you can punish pixels which are, for example, uncertain, and you can do that. So then you just have a version that will give you that will give you results that have a certain low L2 norm or a weighted L2 norm. You can do bilinear total variation, and here you introduce shift matrices. So this is a shift matrix, and this shift matrix does nothing else than shift the image by one or two, essentially by u pixels and by v pixels. So u is the shift into x direction, v is the shift into y direction, and then you subtract the two from each other and take the L1 norm. So you can put this kind of regularizer into your optimization, and this would be the probabilistic version. And if you then use this probabilistic version, you end up with nothing else than this, what is called the bilinear total variation, that you plug into your optimization problem, and then you solve it again using gradient descent or other iterative optimizers. And what you can also do is you can use a Huber prior. And the Huber function is something very nice. So typically, if you have L1 norms, so an L1 norm will have the absolute value somewhere. And the problem with the absolute value is that if you want to, so this is this function here, right? Okay, so this is the absolute value function. And the problem with this function is that if you want to use it in an iterative gradient-based optimization scheme, you always run into trouble when you try to determine a gradient here, right? So this doesn't have a continuous gradient because the gradient switches. Because here you have x, and on this side you have minus x, and you don't have a continuous gradient at the boundary at zero. And you can make this better if you use something like the Huber loss function. And the Huber loss function now uses the trick that it defines a piecewise function. So if your absolute value of z is smaller than a given value tau, then you choose 0.5 z to the power of 2. So this is a quadratic function. And if it's larger, otherwise, you take a scaled version of the absolute value function. And the nice thing is that this piecewise function has a continuous gradient. Because what you do is, well, you introduce your boundaries here, and you say, up here, it is still my absolute value, and up here, it is still my traditional. So this is the absolute value, and this is like the On the left-hand side, it must be minus x to the negative value. But here in between, it behaves like a parabola. And you choose it in such a way that you have a continuous gradient at this position and at this position, and then you can solve this problem down here. So what you essentially use is like some sandpaper, like taking the original absolute value function and use sandpaper in here. And the nice thing is, if you now do a gradient optimizer, you have a well-defined continuous gradient everywhere in the function, and it behaves very similar to an L1 norm. So these Huber functions and Huber norms are very popular in optimization right now, because you can use gradient-based optimizers with this one very efficiently. So this is... many people use this a lot, and it's very commonly used. So this will then result in the following objective function. So you still have your data fit term, and then you have lambda times a capital Huber function, which is like the vector-valued version of the Huber function here, the Huber norm, of d times x, and now d is an operator that penalizes high gradients in x. So you can just use x. Then you would have you would try to optimize for a sparse solution of x, and you can also put in some additional matrix that converts your x into a different domain, and then you optimize in this domain. So this is why there is a d in here. So often, you want to use something like total variation in combination with this. Okay, so this is then the final MAP super resolution algorithm. So you register all your frames yi to yk. So if you don't know the motion, you have to register them. If you know the motion, then you don't have to do the step. So you already know how the different images are aligned to each other. And in the next step, you create your total system matrix. So a part of the system matrix you probably have to do by measurement, that you know the point spread function of your system. Then you create one vector of your super resolved of your low resolution observations. Then you select an image prior and pre-compute regularization operators like this matrix ZX and D if required. And then you plug your entire optimization problem into a library that does conjugate gradients or some limited memory. So L in BFGS is BFGS is a limited memory version of the BFGS algorithm. Okay, and then you plug it in and you solve it. Good. So you probably have a library to do that. There's also, so this algorithm you can also find in open source GPU implementations and so on. So you can do that also on the graphics card. And there you go. So now you take 6 frames. This is what you put in, and this is what you get out. Super resolution image. Nice. Do we have more? No, we only have this example. I should put some more examples in here, because this liver, who noticed that this is a liver? Why does the liver look like this? Because what you're seeing here in this image is actually a phantom of a liver, and it lies on a table. This is why the liver looks like this. Okay, so maybe this is not a very intuitive example. But you can argue that the edges are much nicer in this image than in this image. And now you can also see details like the stripe up here, and also this flap here is also much nicer visible. Okay, good. So take-home messages, you can do super resolution from real camera images, and generally real cameras have a finite resolution, blur, and image noise. Super resolution enables the recovery of a higher resolution image, but be careful, we don't do the stuff with magnifying reflections from cars. We are not yet there. But you can increase the resolution a bit. And there is a single frame versus multi-frame super resolution. And you can either use prior knowledge or sensor fusion for a single frame super resolution. And you can use multiple images for multi-frame super resolution. And here is some very nice papers that you can have a look at if you're interested in super resolution. Pretty good read. Okay, do we have any questions so far? Who wants to go home now and implement a super resolution algorithm? Very well. Good. I mean, it's your questions. I can ask you more questions, but this will only expand. Yes?
So I'm wondering, when we introduce regularizers there, I mean, we just engineer them. So how can we be sure that they won't introduce artifacts? So, I mean, obviously we can just test. So
yes.
Apply something in, see yes. if our super resolution fits, but
yes.
even though we don't, so it's the same with learning. It's, we don't know how it will behave on stuff we didn't test.
Yes, of course. So the question is whether can your regularizer introduce something that you don't want in there? Yeah, potentially it can, but can you guarantee that your measurement system actually measures what you want it to have? How about defect pixels? How about other artifacts that appear in the measurement anyway? So in the end, you have to have a task, and you have to see if your device, if your image processing chain is able to fulfill this task. And at the end of the day, what we are interested in is either more efficient and or more safe procedures. This is what we want to have. So we want to increase safety, and we want to generally help doctors to perform at a higher efficiency their surgeries, or decrease, for example, complications. So if you do minimally invasive surgery, there's generally the benefit that the patient doesn't have to stay as long in hospital, things like that. And this is good for the patient. And by the way, it's also good for the healthcare system because it just generates fewer costs by staying in hospital. So you can increase the cost for the surgery itself because you're still saving money. Any more questions? Be aware, only use this for good purposes. Yes? Okay. Then see you on Thursday.
Do you have some more examples?
Hmm?
Do you have some more examples?
Yes, I do, but I didn't bring them with me. Yes, I have more examples. So, but they need to go to the slides. Definitely. So I will urge somebody to put the examples into the slides and then upload them to the website. Okay? Good. Then see you on Thursday.